Hey everybody, I'm Tom Scott, chairman of the Nantucket Project, back again today with RP Eddy. RP, I want to start with, we're doing tonight our second neighborhood gathering down in New Orleans. The first one was last week, very powerful. We gather groups of people to have conversations about what's going on. You know, in New Orleans, or let's say in Louisiana, 70% of the people who've died are African American. In Milwaukee, where 27% of the residents are Black, nearly twice as many African Americans have tested positive for the virus than whites. This is happening all over the place. This is true in Chicago. What do you make of this?
Well, Wisconsin and Milwaukee, I know, is better than the other cities, perhaps having gone to high school there. Wisconsin... great history as a progressive state. Milwaukee, really bad history as the most segregated city in America, or one of them. And segregation in all instances means worse nutrition, worse access to healthy food, worse access to healthcare, quality healthcare. And perhaps that's part of what you're seeing there. The trends, you know, look, the same statistics hold true on infant maternal death, right, pre-corona, on dying of obesity-related or cardiovascular-related illnesses too early. So we already know that in America, particularly the African-American minorities, are dying earlier than non-African-American minorities when it comes to preventable health-related issues. And I think the linear assessment is that it's, again, access, not good access to healthy foods, called food deserts, living somewhere where the bodega or the small grocery store is all that's available and it doesn't have as many healthy foods, and less access to high quality healthcare. So it's no surprise. And we do know that corona is pretty big on comorbidities, right? So folks who have, we went over the other day, but obesity, heart issues, smoking, emphysema, asthma, COPD, tend to have a higher case fatality rate from corona than those who don't. And that same group of diseases I just mentioned is more prevalent in African-American communities than others in America.
I spoke this morning with a woman named Ai-Jen Poo, and she runs an organization that organizes domestic workers. And domestic workers are particularly challenged right now, largely out of work. You know, they tend to be paid, many of them, under the table. It's a very difficult situation. She's rallied, and Felipe, if you wouldn't mind, if you could put up the website where people can donate. They've already raised $3 million to help these people out. But I bring it up as a general point, and it relates to the point we were just describing, which is we're seeing this uncovering in many ways of, or certainly at a minimum, greater focus on some of the more troubled areas within the country. I feel like this issue is becoming bigger and bigger each day. And, you know, I think it's going to be one of these things when, because you talked about, you know, the COVID, what did you call it? The COVID commission post facto. Yeah. I think a big part of this thing is going to be a lot about social issues, perhaps far bigger than any such commission of its kind. Does that make sense?
Well, there's a big acceleration going on right now of conversations that have been brewing for a long time. And it's almost impossible, I guess it depends on the elections, but it's highly likely we come out of corona, and we're going to. It's highly likely we come out of this and have real conversations about the social safety net, because we've now seen about the size of government, role of government, and social safety net. And we've now seen in stark contrast, you know, people dying because those things have been reduced over decades, right? I mean, it is a fact. It's not a partisan comment to say we've reduced those things over decades. Size of government, quality of government, social safety net, access to quality health care have decreased over time. It's been a choice we've made as a nation. Hospital beds have decreased over time, a choice we made as a nation. And now that we're seeing, you know, you get what you pay for, right? So this is what happens when all of a sudden you need the government to lead. And I would just say, as an interesting, not interesting, a sad footnote to that, this is also what happens internationally into American prestige when we decide not to be able to be present to help other nations, right? So American supremacy is taking a big blow right now. That's another conversation, but I'd love to have it.
So some not so good news on the front, on the numbers front. You know, we are in a very difficult time, and a lot of this is relative, right? If you just look at the numbers from a gross perspective, there's a lot of bad things going on. If you look at the numbers from the point of view of where are the trends and are we improving or are we not improving, that's where perhaps you can find the worst news or the as bad news and perhaps the better news. Yesterday, we felt some degree of optimism. And then today, New York recorded its highest daily death toll at 731. What do you know about these trends? And was yesterday a blip? And how do you think about that? There's some other numbers that seem to suggest things are improving, but I'm curious where you stand on that.
So let's just make sure we understand how to read the numbers. This disease in America, the number of dead is doubling about every 2 to 3 days. We talked about that yesterday, right? So that's a really rapid growth. The disease is spreading virally, right? 2 to 3 days, the number of dead is doubled. Number of infections doubles. Number of ICU admissions doubles. So those numbers are going to keep going up for a while. What matters is the rate in which they are going up. So if the rate of increase is decreasing, that's a victory. So that's what flattening the curve doesn't mean less people died than the day before. It means the rate, it could be, and certainly that'd be great. It means the rate of growth is decreasing. Less people are dying percentage-wise than the increase from the previous day. So let me show you a chart that can maybe make this point a little more clearly. Is that up here now? You see this one?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. Very similar to the one we looked at yesterday, except this is total confirmed deaths on the vertical axis and days effectively setting everyone to the same timeline. All countries are now set to the same timeline, and you can see how successful they were at flattening the curve, right? So here's China. The curve is flat. That is a flat curve. People are still dying, although they've gotten down to very few deaths, but the curve is super flat. That's what you want. South Korea, flattening a lot, right? Less increase of deaths. Now, there's one country, that green line, standing out, still increasing. I take optimism in this top part of the line. I know you can't see it right now, but we can blow this up. The top part of the line, it's just beginning to turn a little bit from a straight up line, more people are dying every day, to slightly less people on a percentage growth basis are dying every day. So that's happening and that's good. So the fact that we had more people reported dead today in New York than we did on Friday isn't surprising, but the percentage of increase is still decreasing and that's good. So yesterday when we said there was some good news, we weren't wrong. The death rate has decreased in New York and it continues to decrease. The total number of dead is higher. The rate of increase is lower. That's the good news. Flattening the curve means less people than the day before on a percentage basis are getting sick and dying. So we were correct about that. The other thing that's notable is New York has shown the weekend reporting tends to be lower. So Monday, Tuesday, the numbers are going to jump up and that's to be expected.
And the rate of hospitalizations continue to go down. So that's sort of the beginning of that funnel, right? Where you see that happen. And so A, I would say that that's good news, but any of this good news, I just want to, just so people and me included has a sense of it, that essentially reflects behaviors of about 9 days ago. Is that right?
Yeah. I mean, yes, exactly. So on average, you're symptomatic 6.5 days after exposure. And on average, it takes 2 days to get bad enough that you want to go to the hospital, at least. And then on average, people, I think, die 18 days after exposure. You know, that's it's a fast and horrible thing. So that means if you're seeing the curve coming down now, that means that, you know, call it 8, 9, 10 days ago, people were exhibiting better behaviors. And that makes sense, right? 14 days ago, I think 14 days ago, New York really locked down. What's today? Tuesday, yeah. About?
And is it the case that we're seeing an accelerated rate of that kind of a lockdown in other places now throughout the country, or there's still the laggards that
still
you worry about?
Still a polka dot. It's still a polka dot matrix. Now, I have a slightly different point of view on this. There are the states right now that are refusing to lock down at the governor's order are North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, a couple of states, effectively Wyoming, right in the middle of America. And these are states that share a couple of things. One, these are states that poll to have very low trust of government. So they're very much, they poll very high in self-reliance. And these states have a lower number of cases, not on a per capita basis, but they do have a lower number of gross cases. These are less populated states. So I, you know, a lot of people say, well, those governors are going to get religion. They're going to lock down those states eventually. I don't know that that's the case. We'll see what happens this week with infection rates and lethality rates, and I hope they don't spike. But these are states where federalism is strong, and the governors will do what they want. Sweden has a similar, different but similar mentality, which is we're not going to really mandate anything. We're just going to expect you to be responsible individuals. Here's a bunch of suggestions about how you should behave, masks, hand washing, social distancing, et cetera. And that's how Sweden's responding to this. Unlike everybody else in Europe, that's kind of the model that those core states are taking. And look, if you knew that everyone had the ability to and the discipline to be disciplined on those behaviors, that's not a bad model. So let's see what happens. Well, I don't want to roll the dice. That's what they're doing, but it's not up to me, and we will see what happens.
Do you have greater optimism as it relates to the critical equipment factors?
I do.
You do.
Remember, we've said from the beginning, you know, you said a quote, Tom, a while ago that I mentioned to one person that's ripping through my world now. People are, you know, are, I think it ended up in a Wall Street Journal editorial. We look forward in dread. We look back in awe. And the reason is because, you know, human ingenuity, American ingenuity is pretty fantastic, right? Look at the Apple computer behind you and the whole story from that, right? So we do a great job with this, and we've seen doctors make ventilators work for not one person, but two and four. We've seen new medicines emerge. We've seen all of science focused on this. And we now have, you know, states sending ventilators to other states, sending back ventilators they don't need. One issue that really broke my heart was the possibility that the hospital would say, Grandpa, I'm sorry, you don't get the ventilator because grandson needs it. And no doctor, no decision maker, no person wants to have to make that choice. And as far as I can tell, we haven't really had to make that choice yet in America. And thank God for that. They've clearly had to make that choice in lots of other countries. And it's heartbreaking.
Yeah. We'll keep a close eye on it. Let's talk about small business. I know a lot of people who are in line now, a lot. There's, you know, we talked about this last week, but there's greater clarity on it. People are actually applying now, a lot of these applications in, and it seems to be the case that now Mitch McConnell, Chuck Schumer are working together to ask for another $200 billion here. It seems to be the case that the need is greater than once thought, which I don't find that surprising. My general reaction is that the overwhelming nature of what we're in right now is unprecedented. And it would be difficult for the government to, I think, accurately project sort of how we got here.
Yeah, I mean, I had a lot of patience for the first bill, I think it was called the phase three bill, because it was done relatively quickly. 600 legislators put it together. It's a sloppy process. The lobbyists have a huge amount of sway in this. And it did make, you know, the banks are in a relatively better position because of that bill. It didn't do enough on small business, perhaps. Phase four bill, initially the president said he wanted that bill to come maybe the end of this month. The president said he wanted it to be about building infrastructure, kind of like the Obama plan, shovel ready projects, this whole thing. I understand now it's less likely to fund infrastructure, more likely to fund small business. You can do both, by the way. But we are in an extraordinarily different economic situation than America's ever been. And I think just about everybody is encouraging the president just to release all brakes and flood as much money into the zone as he can. And I think we need to have more support for small businesses, clearly. And small businesses employ a huge amount of America, but we don't have a strong lobbying voice. I'm very positive. It's positive news that $200 billion is now being headed to small business, hopefully.
So, RP, more news on Brett Crozier, USS Teddy Roosevelt. What do you know?
Well, just recap. So, Brett Crozier, Captain Brett Crozier, head of the nuclear aircraft carrier, the Teddy Roosevelt, wrote a memo that became very public saying we have to protect our soldiers from the corona outbreak that he had on board, and asking the military to realize this wasn't a time of war and we didn't need to put people in harm's way. It was a very courageous letter. And we read it here together, Tom. And then the Secretary of Navy fired him, took away his command of the Teddy Roosevelt. And it's a 9-year process to take over command of a ship. He was 5 months into it, highly respected captain, definitely on his way to 2 stars. If he had finished that tour, 100% chance he would have become a 2-star admiral, and that's a humongous deal. And he was that quality of, he is that quality of leader in person. The Secretary of Navy fired him, claiming that the letter was effectively CC'd to too many people, not put into the classified system. And that it was effectively alarmist, that we weren't, you know, you were having these conversations with us. Why did you grandstand? Why did you write this letter? And you're fired. I don't have confidence in you as a military leader. Now, he was maintained his rank as captain, but he lost the Teddy Roosevelt command. Since then, Crozier got off of the ship, and we should show the video of his crew, 4,000 people in the Teddy Roosevelt, chanting his name, Captain Crozier, as he walked the gangplank for his final moment on that ship and got into a sedan and left. And that became a viral video, this crew thanking their leader for trying to protect them and losing his job in the process. At least that's how I presume that crew felt. And that probably should have been the end of the story, and probably a black mark on the Navy for decades to come, and a big question and a chilling effect for leaders. The Secretary of the Navy made, in my estimation, a really profound error the other day, silly error. He flew to Guam to their Teddy Roosevelt, got on the Teddy Roosevelt, got in the little PA box, you know, they can speak throughout the whole ship. They don't all stand in one place. They stay where they are, and the little voice pipes in through the speakers. And in a profanity-laced tirade, he yelled at them for chanting for their captain who left and for kind of falling for it. And didn't they realize that their captain was a naive fool? And then he left the ship. He didn't even meet anybody. He was there for 30 minutes, flew all the way to Guam to do that. He probably flew to Guam to destroy his career, is my guess. So apparently even President Trump is getting upset by this behavior. I have no idea why that Secretary of Navy, I think he's an acting Secretary of Navy, I have no idea why he would have done that. There are a lot of politics going on around Captain Crozier right now. That acting Secretary of Navy wants the real job very badly. There is another person who's already been nominated as Secretary of Navy who's going to get the job. I think that the acting my opinion, the acting secretary thought this was a chance that he could try to get that full-time job, and he just played his cards wrong. But you know, it's a great example of just, you know, if you're in a hole, stop digging. But he kept going, and there we are. It's becoming a microcosm of this whole story about leadership, about speaking truth to power, about taking care of people versus other missions. And it's a sad and fascinating story. I think they were up to about 150 infected people in the Teddy Roosevelt, including Captain Crozier himself, who was came down with Corona.
You know, at the appropriate time and related to this, in some ways related to this, I'd love to have a conversation about leadership in times like these. And just as a way to sort of contextualize where we are, contextualize some of the qualities that have been historically effective in these moments and how that, you know, manifests itself. And I don't want it to be necessarily a finger pointing thing, but I think it would be interesting in a moment like this to sort of analyze where we are and a way of thinking about it. You know, Churchill comes to mind, these critical moments and the different impacts of leadership. I mean, there's sort of the basic tactical things, there's the emotional things. I'd like to have that conversation sometime over the next few days.
I'd love to do that. And I'll tell you one quick thing on leadership now. One thing we learned after 9/11, one thing we learned after 08, one thing I've learned getting to work on crises before, downing of civilian airliners, certain aspects of war, people get fatigued, but they don't know they're fatigued. People get tired, but they don't know they're tired. People are making bad decisions, but they don't know they're making bad decisions. So in this instance, all of us, first of all, we're individual leaders now to protect ourselves. If you're a family leader, a corporate leader, a mayor, a governor, a president, you have to understand this is when people make stupid mistakes. It's moments of high stress with complexity that you're not familiar with a playbook that you don't have. And this is when errors are made. So the solution is to watch each other, stay social, do sanity checks, talk to your friends. How you doing? What's going on? Checking in on you. Let me question your thinking on that and get replacements. Have others there to step in for you for a little while. And when we talk later, Tom, I'll tell you the story of how the British government during the IRA bombing and terrorist attacks, how they established a process in the leadership rooms during the peak of a crisis to ensure this was happening.
You know, in my own tiny world, and it is admittedly tiny, I had a very challenging 3 weeks that I got rest this weekend. And I know, I'm just observing in real time, how differently I started to view the world yesterday than I did at the end of last week. And at the end of last week, I was in fights. I was moving fast. I was moving hard. I made some decisions that were not good, just to your point. And that was 3 weeks, three stressful weeks, 3 weeks with not great sleep, with really long days, fear at different times, resolve at other times. Anyway.
So this is what we're talking about.
How not to be stupid.
This is by my dear friend Adam Robinson, pre-publication copy. You're stupid, as I just described. You're stupid under stress. You're stupid in novel terrain. You're stupid with novel people. And if you can note those things, then you can be less stupid.
Yeah. RP, thank you as always. More to come this week. And we'll talk more.
Thanks, Tom. Great to see you. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, guys.